Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kowinski. Culture,
comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends,
pop. This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 91 of the Culture Pop Podcast. I'm Steve Mason, and that's Sue Kowinski.
We're in our 90s.
We're in our 90s, yes. Thank God we're not. All right, one of the most powerful movies of 2020 is Sound of Metal. It tells the story of Ruben, played by the incredible Riz Ahmed, a drummer for a heavy metal band who suddenly loses his hearing. He has to learn how to deal with deafness. It is streaming now on Amazon Prime. And joining us right now is the director, Darius Martyr. Darius, thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it.
This is such a pleasure.
So I got to tell you up front, I see a lot of movies. I've seen everything. And Sound of Metal is my favorite movie of 2020. It is just incredible in so many ways.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that. I really appreciate it.
So where did this story come from? I understand the evolution took a long time. Sort of take us through that process.
Okay. Well, yeah, it was a little unusual, actually. I mean, it took a long time, but I think one of the things that made the project so unusual and something I really love about it is that it began, first of all, with a relationship to my dear friend Derek C. in France. And we've worked a lot together. We wrote Place Beyond the Pines together. But before we talked about anything, when we met 13 years ago, within basically 30 seconds of meeting, we were speaking about the seed of an idea that would actually become this movie. And he was shooting a film called Jucifer at the time. Derek was a drummer himself. He had experienced some hearing loss. And so he was shooting this documentary that he was interested in. This is the first thing we spoke about, was introducing this hybrid idea to this doc. And I was really lit up by that idea. I was shooting a doc at the time. And this band was really intriguing because Jucifer is made up of two people in a relationship that look very much like Ruben and Lou. And they're not at all, on a character level, there's not a lot of crossover. But as a pure construct, that idea really struck me right off the bat as just being beautiful, because here they were playing against this wall of sound every night. And Jucifer in particular is maybe the loudest band on the planet. I mean, really, the Amber, who plays guitar, she plays so loud that when she hits the strings, her hair blows from the sound coming from
Wow.
Sickeningly loud. And you know, Edgar, who plays drums, you know, once knocked himself unconscious playing the drums. I mean, like they're just, it's just this incredibly visceral experience. So that really struck me as a symbol of relationship in general and codependence and the way that two people's sounds and vibrations can merge and what would happen if those sounds were torn apart, you know, and challenged. And so right off the bat, I was really into this concept, and I started playing with this footage. And, you know, interestingly, you know, editing is writing, and I was doing a lot. I've done a lot of editing in my career, and I love editing, but it's writing. It's writing with picture. It's writing with sound. And while I was playing with some of that footage, I kind of got caught on this POH, this point of hearing, this idea of that. It struck me, and it wasn't really part of that project, but I got so obsessed with it. And it became clear a number of years later, a couple of years later, that Derek was never going to make that movie. It was never going to get done. It was beautiful. It had a real lyrical spirit, but it wasn't complete, and it was just hard to see how it was going to get finished. And I knew I wasn't going to make Derek's movie. I needed to make mine. So I adopted it. And as Derek describes, it was like his little baby that was left in an alley, you know, and I just needed someone to kind of come along and pick it up and adopt it. And so that's what I did. And that was after having this wonderful period of being able to nurture it in a different form. And then I began writing, and that's where some of these deeper themes for me came in, you know, some of the themes around the specific aspects of this relationship of Ruben and Lou, who Ruben and Lou were. That took many years to develop. And I have a very kind of a circuitous and deep writing process that eventually involved my brother, Abraham. And we probably wrote 1500 to 2000 pages to get to this script.
Wow.
It was really, and it was just an incredible, rich journey. You know, it's so interesting. You never know. Nobody ever really knows the pages that don't show up as the journey, as part of the journey to get to the pages that do.
The casting was so amazing. What role did you see the lead actors portray that made you want to cast them in this film?
Well, you know, initially, of course, I didn't know much about Riz actually until way later. But, you know, and I had spoken to, this was a real odyssey. So this is now, you know, 13 years since I met Derek, many, many years of casting. Once I had written the script, you know, 5 years of casting, and I've met a lot of people and talked with a lot of people. And so, you know, I saw Riz, people brought Riz to my attention, and I watched The Night Of. What I saw in The Night Of is interesting. I mean, you know, obviously Riz is like really an immense talent.
That miniseries is incredible.
It really is incredible. And I think what everyone recognized in Riz from that series is that, you know, he surprises you in the degree of like peripheral depth. You know, you think, okay, here's a guy who has this, you know, fragility and sensitivity and, you know, these watchful eyes, as you see in the beginning of that. And then you start to realize, wait a second, this guy also has this power. He has this innate power. He has an anger. He has a virility. He has a, you know, and these things are, what this really means is that this is a person who has a really deep, rich garden to draw from. When he, as an actor of real life experiences, he's just a very deep person, and his ability to access that has a lot to do with his raw talent. So that was really an easy connection for me to make, but I still didn't know until I sat with him why he was Ruben.
Yeah.
And you really don't know that until you really look and talk to someone.
Your hearing is deteriorating rapidly.
We'll come back. Till then, Lou, we just keep going, okay?
No.
Lou, no. Let's play tomorrow. Let's see what it's like, okay? I'm gonna be like a click track. You can play to me.
I can't hear you. Do you understand me? I can't. I'm deaf. I'm deaf.
You know, his process has to be pretty incredible. I mean, the scene where he does the alphabet really fast in sign language is so impressive. How long did he work to learn sign language, especially at that capacity?
Well, it's interesting about the alphabet because actually Riz could do that 5 or 6 times faster than he did in that scene.
Wow.
Because that scene was meant to be, you know, not the end of that process. You know, so chronologically in the film, he was at the, you know, the beginning, not the very beginning. But what's fascinating, you know, that you ask about the alphabet. Now, Riz, first of all, he moved to Brooklyn. I had a really high bar for what I wanted an actor to do for this role. And it's kind of a ridiculous, an audacious thing for a first time filmmaker to ask any actor. You know, it's a lot of trust to put into a film, especially when no one knows what that film will be. And, you know, so I wanted someone not just to show up and do their lines in ASL, but someone who could actually become some degree of fluent, so that when you were at the stage where Ruben would have been in this community for 4 to 6 months, you would have to be able to communicate with people. So Riz moved to Brooklyn. He took on both drums and sign language for seven months every day, hours. You know, and there was one story. It was really wonderful as a filmmaker because I had spent so long being kind of disappointed by people's ability to commit to process, and you know, it's a lot to ask of someone. And here I was in Brooklyn and in Fort Greene, and I went to get a coffee one morning, and I walked to the coffee shop early in the morning, and I looked to my right, and there's Riz, sitting across from Jeremy Lee Stone, who is his ASL instructor. And I just turned and I watched, and they're sitting outside and they're just having a full-on conversation in ASL. And my jaw just dropped. I thought, this, I have reached the pinnacle right here. You know, this is all I could ever want in life, is to see this kind of commitment. I was just so proud. And he really did walk that walk.
Paul Racy totally blew me away in this. And I was wondering, like, how helpful was he during the filming? Because he comes from a family, both of his parents were deaf. I guess his mom could hear until she was like 5 years old. So like, I mean, did you feel like you struck gold when you got him?
Yeah. I mean, you have to understand what's at stake with this film. I mean, you've seen the film, so you know the film hinges on that character.
Yes.
Right? I always feel like he's the compass of the movie. And, you know, without that degree of veracity in that role, what would this movie be?
I'm trying to save my life.
Reuben, the world does keep moving. It can be a damn cruel place. But those moments of stillness, crappy, mundane world, suddenly becomes radiant and magnificent. All the fear is gone. That place will never abandon you.
I had refused to meet anyone who wasn't from deaf culture for years for that role. And I had really bet the farm that a Paul Racy existed. But how do you find that guy? He's impossible to find, because not only is, you're right, he's a CODA, a child of deaf adults. His first language is ASL. He didn't speak English until he was five or six. So he's not, you know, we don't, as hearing people, fully understand what deaf culture is. And I say we as hearing people, some people might, but I didn't, you know, going back a number of years, we don't really understand that, you know, there is a distinct culture there, and that's the culture he was born into. That's what he knows. And ASL is not an interpretation of English. ASL is its own language. It doesn't relate to English. So his brain was formed with that language and that culture. And it's interesting you say what a help he was, because, you know, as a CODA, CODAs tend to be the liaison between the hearing and the deaf worlds. Because if their parents are deaf and they're hearing, they end up kind of being the middle person. And they learn, their role in life is often defined by being that helper. And that comes with a lot of, there's a lot of pain involved in that. You know, as well as there's beauty in it as well. But they're kind of an invisible people, because they have this culture, it's who they are. And yet when we look at CODAs, we would just see a hearing person. You know, and we don't understand that what actually created these people. And I met many, many CODAs, and they're beautiful, deviant, wonderful people who have been really invisible, largely, many of them. And Paul is one of those. And what I found in almost all of them is that they're incredibly empathic, because they have been caretakers their whole life. So one of the things that, when you say help, how did he help? Well, he helped in all ways. You know, when I approached Paul, I went and met him actually at a CODA convention in Rhode Island. And having watched a tape that he sent, which absolutely, I literally cried watching this tape. He is so powerful. And I went to meet Paul, and I talked to him about taking care of this group of deaf addicts that were going to be, many of whom, deaf addicts. And what would that responsibility feel like? And, you know, Paul's answer to that question was, basically showed me that was the greatest and truest and most incredible responsibility he could possibly imagine, taking care of this group of people. And so when I drove him finally to the land and the house that I had found after 4 years of searching for one, you know, tears streamed down his face at the thought of, holding this group of people in his own arms and taking care of this group. And at any moment, if something felt wrong or less than legitimate or less than authentic, or, you know, not from a deaf perspective, Paul was the first, you know, he would, I asked him and wanted him to just kick my ass every which way. But one thing I didn't want from Paul was for him to ever be in a role that was like, to not ever be interpreting on set. You know, he needed to be in his world. And that was a very important thing for Paul, for Joe, for the character of Joe. You know, Joe was not going to be an interpreter. He was going to be there to hold his group. And we had other interpreters to do that role. So he could really focus on Joe and be Joe and not be Paul, you know, and that was important.
How important was it for you to be able to cast actual deaf people in this
film? Well, it was, I wouldn't have made the film any other way. And I didn't make the film any other way. You know, I could have made this film more easily earlier in many different ways than I did. I pretty much made the film in the hardest way possible. You know, Hollywood wasn't jumping up and down with excitement about the idea that I was casting deaf people. It wasn't like people were dying to finance this movie, you know, like, yay, this is a get rich quick scheme. But it was never going to be any other way. And so it was of the utmost importance. It would be so wrong to do anything else. And of course we have done those things over and over again in Hollywood. But you know, on every level, it's obviously kind of insensitive to do that. But just in terms of filmmaking, I mean, what we're after is truth. What we're after is something alive and wonderful happening on the screen and something true and real. The idea of trying to get actors to pretend to be something they could never in a million years be, is just ridiculous. I mean, well, who would want to do that is my question. You know, that deaf people that filled the screen, man, the first cut of the movie was 4 hours because I just had so much. Oh God. I mean, it was just so rich and there's such a world of talent in the deaf, really, really is a world of talent in deaf culture and deaf community, because deaf people, you know, I don't want this to sound gimmicky. It's actually really true. Deaf people, in my experience, are better listeners. You know, hearing people, we're very used to looking at our phones, doing any number of other things while we're in conversation, while we're listening. Deaf people can't do that. They have to be engaged. They have to be watching. And they listen. And there's a presence that is palpable. It's really, that's what acting's all about. Acting's all about listening, all about reacting. And so there's a world it's just a treasure. It's a treasure. I really hope there are just many, many deaf films that we get to see.
You know, Paul Racy, it's such a sensitive, kind of tender, vulnerable performance. And the thing I love, and I think this goes for the other deaf actors, is there's a stillness about them. Which I absolutely love. It's very, very still. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that's that presence. You know, it's interesting. It's not quiet. It's not quiet. Like, you remember the dinner in the film. It's very, yes, very noisy. Yeah, it's not quiet, but I think you're speaking to a presence, a sense of, you know, we fill space with noise. We fill space with conversation, with this kind of filler. And the experience, certainly as hearing people being within deaf culture, is one of a different kind of a stillness, at least for us, I think. You know, I think it's important to recognize that there's a very big difference between quietness and stillness. And, mm-hmm. and you know, deafness is not a monolith. Within deaf culture, there's all manner of people, of course. And there are addicts, there are crooks and liars and lawyers and everything, right? Yep. And so, you know, there are some things that are endemic to the culture. And I think that's what you're pointing out. And I did see that myself. Yeah.
You know, the sound design on this movie, I understand it was an incredible journey. And the thing that's amazing about it for me, and talk about the process, is that it almost instructed me on what it must be like to be deaf. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is a very unusually committed first person perspective. And it is absolutely meant, you know, if Ebert said that films are empathy machines, this is the journey we're going on, is we're going on a journey of empathy. And in order to have that empathy, you have to feel something that maybe you haven't ever felt before, you know, that experience. And so absolutely, this was a journey to create a sonic experience that most of us have never heard. I had never heard, you know, and yeah. And deafness isn't quietness. Deafness is vibration. Deafness is many things. It's not silence. What actually literally is silence is when you get a cochlear implant, you actually cut off all of those, you cut off the cochlea, and you don't have those vibrations anymore. You don't have those low frequencies anymore. So you actually do have silence, but deafness is filled with kind of a spectrum, you know? And so that's where we got to get into this really deep, nuanced sonic language that did take a long time.
Yeah, like there were a few scenes where you cut back and forth from normal conversation to what Ruben hears. And I was curious, like when you edited the film, how many times did you recut scenes in order to get that perfect balance?
Oh, unbelievable. And I'm really glad you asked that question, Susan, because, you know, I think people don't understand, you know, we talk about sound design, but you can't really talk about the sound design without the picture edit in this film. You know, they really go hand in hand and they need to work in tandem. So in fact, we were working deeply with sound when we were doing the first picture edit. And I was actually traveling to the sound studio in Paris in tandem while we were cutting picture. And we had to really work this in so many different ways. And a lot of that was about pushing boundaries. And then it was about pulling back and really understanding how far to push. You know, we never wanted this to be an idea or a gimmick. It always had to be in service of something really lyrical and in service of something true, you know, and never pushing past that point, but always pushing up to the right point. You know, my editor, Mikkel Nielsen, is really, really next level. And he's the quickest editor in the world. I mean, he's so fast that I could talk about a concept and he would sit there kind of nodding at me. And by the end of me, when I was talking, I would say, yeah, we should give that a try. And he said, I already did. You know, he would, I was like, what are you talking about? And he said, I did it here. Let's watch. You know, it was so fast. So we could try a lot and we did. We had a gazillion cuts, you know, and that's incredibly important. We turn this thing inside and out. Although I will say a lot of it is in the script, you know, a lot of it is a lot of the architecture knew what it was. Some of it we had to find.
Why did you not want the cast to look at the dailies?
Well, for a lot of reasons. And that actually that speaks to a lot of the process that I'm interested in as a director. And it's about, you know, acting can very quickly, and film sets can very quickly be about mirrors and the frontal lobe and about like, oh, let's go look at this and let's see, and maybe we should try this and maybe we should do this and let's talk about this and let's analyze this. And what can happen is it actually moves further and further away from the actual process and presence in front of a camera. And so number one, I didn't let people see dailies because I didn't want people getting into analyzing themselves. I don't think that's helpful. It's a little like a Zoom meeting where you're looking at your own self rather than just looking at someone else, you know.
Sure.
It's not something that brings out truth. It brings, it becomes an echo chamber, a kind of a narcissism of sorts. And but that actually speaks to a, you know, my process was that going back many, many months, you know, one of the instincts I had with Riz, it's not hard to have the instinct that he's talented. That's easy. He is. It's also not hard to see how bright he is. You know, he's so brilliant and deep. But the thing with Riz is he's so bright. He's such a thinker that what I wanted him to do is actually move that out of the way. I wanted him to enter into a process that was wholly different from anything he had experienced before. So I didn't let him analyze script with me the whole time we were working. I actually urged him into a completely physical process. And that was the whole 7 months leading up to the shoot. And then once we got to set, and even the night before, I remember we had this fantastic little fight about dailies. And Riz made a very good case that this helped his process and that he absolutely had to see dailies. And I said, Riz, I am not going to be your enabler. It was very funny. and to Riz's credit, he just started laughing. And, that's the beauty of Riz is that, you know, Riz is very intense. There's nothing easy about the performance you saw on the screen. It was a very intense process, even in so far as, you know, people around us couldn't believe it. People on the set, crew members, it was intense. He was a full method process. He couldn't hear anything. He had hearing aids that emitted white noise. He couldn't hear his own voice. Even Riz and I couldn't talk to each other in between shots. Wow. We had to write things down. It was very, very intense. And, but that's what it took. You know, that performance you see on the screen is pure instinct. It's visceral. It's coming from that place of impulse. Those are the things that excite me as a director.
What would you say is the most enlightening thing that you've learned about the deaf community while researching and working on this film?
Well, you know, one thing I saw is, I learned so much from working with the deaf community, and I continue to learn. There was a moment when, one of the things I was interested in doing on the screen here is showing there are many, many different forms of deafness and versions of being deaf. It's not one thing. And so one of the people that I cast came into a casting session, and I moved toward him to shake his hand, and he got very rattled. And I only realized later he was a very sensitive, very intense person. I ended up casting him, and I realized later that he grew up with two deaf and blind parents. So his parents had never seen or heard him.
Wow.
And I was so moved by this. I just thought, my God. And then I realized, I was told, and again, I was told by Paul, who is so sensitive and sees everything. And so, you know, in that way that I was explaining to you earlier, And I was told that, you know, he was losing his sight now. And
wow.
And he was falling into that dark world without hearing either. And I thought, my God, that is just so profound. So what I saw though with this man is that all of the people around Joe Toledo, whose son Domenico Toledo is in the movie, who's the boy on the slide, you know, they noticed every nuance of when the person like him was having a hard time. Maybe the lights were too dim and he couldn't see. They would move to him, and Joe would move to him, and Joe would take his hand and he would sign on his hand, which is the only way that he could understand.
Wow.
And it was so beautiful to watch that degree of sensitivity amongst strangers. These aren't people who knew each other, right? So, And I thought, you know what? We don't see that. We do not see that in an able-bodied world. We don't.
Right.
We simply don't. We walk around in our own orbits and we hardly notice anything because we don't have to. And what I saw is that many of these people have spent their entire lives being ignored and dismissed. And so when they see other people in need, they move toward them. And that really rocked me.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I love about the movie, and I'm not a big fan of movies that are just sort of black and white at the end.
Yeah.
Good guy, bad guy. There's such an ambivalent sort of way that the movie ends. It feels like Ruben may or may not embrace his deafness.
Yeah.
In your head, do you know what Ruben does next?
I do. I don't know. It's not about whether he goes literally here or literally there for me. It's about the energy with which he does it. And so I know what Ruben has in the end. You know, mm-hmm. I know that he sits in his own body for the first time, you know, mm-hmm. and he, you know, it's really a deeply, it's almost like a religious parable, you know, I'm not a religious person and it's not a religious movie necessarily, but it's that journey of, you know, that you think you're on. And when you are in your own self and can actually be there and the world becomes radiant, that speaks to, you know, less about where you go next and more about who you are when you go there.
Yeah, you know, I got the feeling when he was just kind of staring out and he took the cochlear out and I felt that it was like, I don't belong in the hearing world anymore. I tried to go back to it, but that's not where I belong. And I actually saw him going back to
right,
the treatment
sure.
center.
Well, he has a family there. And that's a distinct possibility. But I think what's interesting is that, you know, yes, there is that potential truth. But I think, you know, one of the things that the film is playing with is this idea of identity and who we think we are. And, you know, much of that is, you know, we can get into trouble by putting those labels on ourselves, because when they are challenged, we're left having to deal with ourselves again. You know, so and that's true whether you're part of a deaf community or you're part of a metal band or you're part of a relationship. That shows itself in a lot of different ways in this movie. So yeah, he when he takes those out, yes, there is this very literal, like moving from hearing to not hearing. But I also think that there's a symbolism there about, you know, about presence and actually more about letting go of the thing you thought you were after, you know? And we all have those, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We all have those. And they, you know, and I think it accompanies great literature throughout the ages.
Well, it has been a great pleasure to have you on the show. It is such a moving film. It's such an accomplishment. You know, I used to own an art house movie theater.
Oh, that's great.
I got a sense of how difficult it is to accomplish what you just did. So congratulations to you. We really appreciate you coming on. And I could not recommend a movie more highly. It is streaming now on Amazon Prime. That was awesome, man. Thank you.
Yeah, such a pleasure. It was really fun. Thank you, guys.
Congratulations, man.
Oh, thanks so much for the kind words, you guys. All best.
You bet. You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Wow. You know, I said to him, but I mean, just a fantastic achievement.
It's unbelievable. Well, you know, the Oscar for sound design is going to this film.
No question. And I'll tell you what, Riz Ahmed is going to be nominated for Best Actor. Paul Racy, I think is going to be nominated for best actor. I mean, I think those are two performances that are absolutely going to be recognized by the Academy. And I love this scene. And, you know, I hope I'm not spoiling this too much, but I love the scene between Paul Racy and Riz Ahmed when Ruben leaves that deaf community. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's moving. It's a little bit heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. They're both very vulnerable in that moment. I just think it's sort of, for me, the heart of the movie.
Yeah, you know, reading a lot about, you know, the deaf community, while researching for the interview.
Sure.
There was that moment where Racy said to Ruben, we don't look at being deaf as a disability. You know, this is a community.
Yeah.
And how they were like totally against him getting the cochlear and trying to hear again.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking to myself, you know, Here's the question.
What would you do?
Well, I mean, if I had the opportunity to hear again, I mean, it's different if you've never heard before.
Sure.
I think it probably harder because you had it and then you don't have it. And if you had the opportunity to do it, I would do it. I mean, I feel like I would, you know?
Yeah, you'd do what he did.
I would. Yeah. I would for sure. But just the fact that it was frowned upon from their point of view,
sure.
From people who had never, that never had their hearing,
yep.
That it's like, this is who we are. And it's an insult for you to be here, wanting to hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Almost like it's a gift.
Exactly.
In a very sort of, spiritual way that it's like a gift. Right. Hey Sue, thank you very much. Great talking to you. The movie Sound of Metal is streaming on Amazon Prime. Absolutely love it. Go watch it right now. That wraps up. Oh, by the way, I forgot. The Culture Pop podcast is brought to you by my friend Jacob Imrani. Jacob is, if you're involved in a car accident or a motorcycle accident or a slip and fall or anything like that, you've got to call Jacob. He is the one and only guy. You know, you see the billboards all over town. You know, he's the biggest. If you need a team of people to work on your case, Jacob is the guy. He is the captain of that team. And you can find him at calljacob.com or call 844-24-JACOB. That's 844-24-JACOB. And Sue, are you going to sing the catchy jingle with me?
Okay, I will.
Okay, ready?
Mm-hmm.
Accident
or
injury.
Call Jacob
Imrani.
Call Jacob.
Very good. You are improving. Should be your New Year's resolution.
You make it sound like you are really great at this.
I actually think I'm a fine vocalist.
Well, you are so mistaken, my friend.
All right. That wraps up this Culture Pop podcast. It's award season, so lots of cool guests coming up. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We appreciate you listening. Thanks a lot and see you next time.